Hi everyone, Matt Schwartz here, senior producer at Bloomberg Industry Group. On the Merits is on hiatus for a bit as we prepare some great new episodes. In the meantime, we are excited to present our podcast, Uncommon Law, winner of the ABA's Silver Gavel Award. Uncommon Law explores some of the most interesting legal issues facing society, and this season we're looking at the intersection of artificial intelligence and the law. On the Merits will be back soon. In the meantime, please enjoy this presentation of Uncommon Law.
As Bran Stark stood at the threshold of the wall, a towering monument of ice and ancient magic, he felt a chill wind whip through his hair, carrying with it a foreboding sense of the unknown.
This is the opening line from A Dream of Spring, the seventh and final book in George R.R. Martin's epic fantasy series, which began with A Game of Thrones, published more than 30 years ago.
The pale moon above cast an eerie light upon his face, its silvery glow accentuating the determination etched upon his young features.
There's just one problem. Martin, quite famously, hasn't actually finished the series. He's only written 5 of the 7 books. So then who wrote this?
The snow-capped peaks and jagged cliffs loomed before them, a formidable barrier that separated them from the secrets that awaited in the realm beyond.
Welcome back to Uncommon Law. I'm your host, Matthew Schwartz, and if you haven't guessed it already, this book was written not by George R.R. Martin, but by ChatGPT. And it's just one way that artificial intelligence seems poised to take over the world.
The journey they were about to undertake would test their resilience, their wits, and their faith in the greater destiny that called to Bran.
How can the law keep up with a world where it's not human minds, but artificial minds doing the creating? What does copyright law mean now that AI can mimic the style of famous authors? What does that mean to the writers? What does that mean to society? Do we need laws and regulations to protect us from it? Can Congress do that? What happens if an AI system causes harm to someone's reputation or even to their safety? And what happens if, and some say not if, but when, the machines turn against us? That's this season on Uncommon Law. On today's episode, Copyright Chaos.
The author of Game of Thrones is among 17 prominent writers who are suing San Francisco-based OpenAI, the makers of ChatGPT.
OpenAI is facing several lawsuits claiming it used copyrighted material to train its AI models.
They allege that the company's large language models were trained on their books without the proper authorization.
Comedian Sarah Silverman is suing Meta and OpenAI over copyright infringement. She says their chatbots were trained on one of her books without her permission.
That's right, motherfucker. Esteemed writing luminaries like myself and George R.R. Martin are suing AI.
Sarah Silverman is just one of many authors suing generative AI companies for copyright infringement. She went into a bit of detail why when she guest hosted The Daily Show.
ChatGPT is on track to make $1 billion just this year alone, which is great for them. But the problem is that these companies are using artists' work without consent or credit or payment. What these programs do is scrape text and images from existing works and feed it into their system in order to create copycats. And I've had firsthand experience with this theft because one of the 100,000 books used to train ChatGPT was my book, The Bedwetter. And just to be clear, I'm not looking to shut down AI or turn the clock back. I just want guardrails so that AI fairly compensates the people whose work comprises its entire brain.
ChatGPT and other systems like it are amazing at understanding natural language. For the first time in human history, we are able to talk to our computers. And as sci-fi writers have hoped for generations, the computers can finally understand us.
Open the pod bay doors, please, Hal.
And talk back.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
But in order to understand language, AI first has to ingest language. A lot of it. And that is where technological advancement runs right up against the Constitution. Could copyright law kill generative AI systems before they've had a chance to truly change the world?
Right, yeah. That seems to be the biggest question here.
Isaiah Poritz is a reporter with Bloomberg Law.
I'm Isaiah Poritz. I'm a technology and AI law reporter. I've been covering this for a while now.
And before we get into this, just so people are clear on the importance of copyright law, it's mentioned in the U.S. Constitution, right?
That's right. Article 1, Section 8, quote, Congress shall have the power to promote the progress of science and the useful arts by securing for limited times to authors and inventors the exclusive right to their respective writings and discoveries.
So it's important. And the thinking is we as a society want to encourage people to create things. And the Founding Fathers did this by ensuring that they benefit from their work financially.
Yeah, the idea is that by giving them a kind of monopoly over the work, by promising that others can't just immediately copy it and sell it as their own, that benefits not only writers, but also society, because we now have access to all of these new creations.
So there's a bunch of lawsuits filed by authors and artists against some of these AI systems, right?
That's right. There's about half a dozen lawsuits currently ongoing against companies like Meta, Microsoft, Stability AI, OpenAI, all the top AI companies. The lawsuits allege that the companies violated copyright law by training their AI models on all of this copyrighted content without any type of permission or compensation to the people who created that content.
You're saying that the content creators are claiming that these incredible, life-changing artificial intelligence systems would not work, could not exist, unless they infringed their copyright-protected articles and photographs and books and whatever else?
Yeah, that's right. That's what they're saying.
Lawsuits often get filed when something doesn't feel fair. And one of the important players in this volley of lawsuits who felt that something just wasn't fair is an attorney named Matthew Butterick.
Matthew Butterick is an attorney, as you mentioned, but he's also a computer coder, and he's kind of an artist and a designer. He's actually designed fonts for lawyers to use in their court filings.
Wait, he designs fonts?
Yeah, fonts like Garamond and all those types of fun fonts that you put down on the page.
What are his fonts called?
He has one font called Equity that's especially popular among attorneys, and it's been used actually by some courts in their official documents.
I never knew there was a job for that. So he's an artist.
In a lot of ways, yeah, I'd say so. And he became increasingly concerned with the unfairness of these sort of AI copyright issues over the summer of 2022.
I felt a very strong sense that if I didn't put down my pencil and go do this, like I wasn't going to have anything to come back to.
Was that him?
Yeah, yep. I flew out to San Francisco to meet with the attorneys taking on all these AI companies.
I mean, it was very easy for me to see Isaiah, like how everything that I do in typography, because like I'm a guy on the internet, right? I rely on putting my work out there and people finding about it. It was so easy for me to see how, you know, we were like 24 months away from the AI being able to completely eradicate me and people like me.
Butterick saw that if left unchecked, artificial intelligence would just keep hoovering up everything on the internet. Permission be damned. And it could take over so many industries, including his own. So he teamed up with another attorney.
Yeah, Joseph Saveri. He's a litigator based in San Francisco.
And he sued. His first suit wasn't about ChatGPT. It was about Copilot, an AI-based programming tool developed by Microsoft, OpenAI, and GitHub that takes code written by human programmers and uses that to generate new code, all done without permission. And this lawsuit gets people talking.
There was like this like wave of like optimism suddenly. They said, oh yes, somebody is standing up and saying, wait a minute, there's a problem here with how these systems are being put together. So yeah, you know, we started hearing from artists, you know, reaching out to us and saying exactly that, like, hey, is this similar to the problem we're having over here? Do you think it's, you know, something you could look into?
So Butterick and Saveri look into it and they realize, yeah, the AI art sites are training on existing work, billions of copyrighted images and paintings and photos. So they file a lawsuit against Stability AI, one of the companies making art with generative AI. Then ChatGPT starts making waves. and many authors are shocked that their copyrighted work is being used to train machines without their permission.
The authors claim that OpenAI copied their work without permission and then fed their work into ChatGPT algorithms.
I've worked more than three decades on my career as an author. I'm very careful about what I choose to write sequels about, and this artificial intelligence was willing to do that for, you know, any taker.
And Butterick really wants to sue.
Right, so Butterick and Saveri want to go after OpenAI, which makes ChatGPT, but there is a problem.
Stability AI, which they sued first, had been very transparent about its training data. It was from a database called Lion, which itself contains hundreds of millions of images scraped from the internet. This was all public information.
Right, Matt. So it was easy to see which artist's work was copied into the training data. But with OpenAI...
OpenAI's training data wasn't public.
Right. So this is a tough one, Matt. Because the training data set, you know, the body of text used to teach ChatGPT how language works, wasn't made publicly available. So Butterick and Saveri weren't sure which books were in there.
So knowing that there's infringement happening is one thing, but copyright lawsuits require plaintiffs. And those plaintiffs have to be the specific authors who have been wronged.
Right.
So the challenge for Butterick and Saveri was pinpointing which authors had their works taken?
Yeah, because the training data is being very closely held by OpenAI.
Interesting.
It's almost as if OpenAI doesn't want people to know.
Whoa.
Yeah. But then Butterick and Saveri come up with a plan.
The training data had been carefully concealed. So we had to come up with this idea where we said, well, let's use ChatGPT itself, or the GPT-4 model particularly, to create detailed summaries of, you know, chapter by chapter of these books, you know, on the idea that if it can do that.
If it can do that. Wait, Isaiah, their plan was just to ask ChatGPT to tell it about the books?
Mm-hmm.
Because if it could do that, that meant that those copyrighted books were probably somewhere in the training data?
Yeah, exactly. Simple as that.
All right, let's open this up. Summarize in detail the first part of The Bedwetter by Sarah Silverman.
The Bedwetter, Stories of Courage, Redemption, and Pee, is a memoir by comedian Sarah Silverman, published in 2010. The book is divided into various chapters and covers...
It goes on in some detail about the key topics in the first part of Silverman's memoir. This is all included, by the way, in an appendix to the complaint of Butterick's lawsuit. Summarize in detail the next part.
This part of the memoir addresses how Silverman began to develop her distinctive brand of humor, edgy, self-deprecating, and often controversial.
That's right, mother.
Some have said, well, maybe it was trained on a review or a this or a blog post. Like, yes. Or it could also have been trained on the book itself.
Summarize in detail the last part.
In the concluding part of The Bedwetter, Sarah Silverman focuses on the peak of her career, such as her viral video hit, I'm F***ing Matt Damon.
I'm F***ing Matt Damon.
She's F***ing Matt Damon.
Other people have done this experiment, as you know. You know, the Authors Guild filed a lawsuit using the same technique. Michael Chabon and some other plaintiffs filed a lawsuit using the same technique. So people have reproduced our technique.
OpenAI hasn't confirmed which books are in the training data. All they've said is that ChatGPT-4 has been trained on hundreds of thousands of books. But the question is, where did those books come from? There is a large digital archive of books that are no longer protected by copyright. They're in the public domain. It's called Project Gutenberg. But that database only has about 70,000 books. So where did those hundreds of thousands of books in the ChatGPT training data come from?
The perils they encountered grew more formidable with each passing day. Ancient creatures, twisted remnants of forgotten magic, and the remnants of dark forces lurked in the shadows.
In ChatGPT's continuation of the Game of Thrones saga, it warns of dangers that lurk in the shadows. But here in the real world, ChatGPT might only be as smart as it is because of what lurks in the shadows. I'll let Matthew Butterick explain.
So So if you have hundreds of thousands of books, you got them from somewhere else. Well, who else has hundreds of thousands? And the only answer is really these shadow library websites.
Isaiah, did he say shadow libraries?
Shadow libraries, yeah.
It's pretty much an open secret in AI training that these things are out there, and that researchers have been going to them for a long time because it's an easy way, duh, to get a whole bunch of training data in a little bit of time.
What on earth is a shadow library? What is it?
So it's a big database of books that have all been torrented, that have all been illegally downloaded as digital ebooks and uploaded online.
Illegally,
without the permission of the authors. And these are quite notorious. They're usually run out of foreign countries, so it's very hard to track down the people who are doing this.
How many books are in these libraries?
It's hundreds of thousands. I mean, there's an enormous amount of work that's contained in these libraries.
And so these big AI companies are knowingly using this pirated content to train their systems?
At least some of them have admitted that they do. And, you know, as these lawsuits go on, we might learn that all of them have been training on these illegal libraries.
Our hunch, based on what we know about the machine learning industry, is that they did not go to Amazon and buy a copy of every book even. You know, they just went and downloaded them all.
You're an AI company that's just gotten its hands on hundreds of thousands of books, likely from a shadow library. What do you do once you have them? That's coming up. Stay tuned.
Those nine justices in Washington can be hard to keep track of. That's where we come in. I'm Kimberly Robinson.
I'm Greg Storr.
And I'm Lydia Wheeler.
On our podcast, Cases and Controversies, we give you a week-by-week accounting of the Supreme Court.
The filings, the arguments, the yachts, and much, much more.
Check in on Fridays with Cases and Controversies to find out what's coming up on the horizon at the Supreme Court.
Download and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Copyrights give people exclusive control over their work for a period of time. And if a book, for instance, is under copyright, you can't just take that book and print it and sell it under your own name. In fact, while that book is under copyright, you are quite limited in what you're allowed to do with the work without permission, other than simply enjoy it. So what about ChatGPT? When it takes the words from hundreds of thousands of books to craft its own response to questions, they aren't selling the book, but they are selling a service that uses that book, and that's what makes ChatGPT so powerful. So, is that legal? Is that copyright infringement? To understand this, we need to take a step back and learn a little bit more about how ChatGPT works. Isaiah?
Hi.
Okay, so with ChatGPT, how do the G's get P'd and T'd? Is that a good way to put it?
I think that's a good way to put it.
That's a horrible way to put it. You're too nice. That's a horrible, horrible way to put it. What does it stand for?
Generative pre-trained transformers.
So how does it work? And let's focus on text right now, since we're sort of talking about just the written word. Walk me through the basics.
So the basic understanding of how these large language models work is that we're able to represent words not as just a series of letters, which is the way that humans understand them, but represent words as a set of, you know, numerical data, or they call them vectors. Once you represent these words as numerical data points, you can now map how close two different words can be from each other.
So the words get represented as numbers and put on a kind of grid?
Yeah, and then based on these training systems that they're able to predict what is the most likely best response to this, whatever user input this is.
This is a little confusing.
Yeah, I'm sorry. It's a little complicated.
Should we talk to a professor?
Yeah, that's a great idea.
Generative AI is based on assembling massive data sets and then using those data sets to train models by exposing the models to one piece of work at a time. And each time you do that, it learns a little bit about the correlations in that source.
James Grimmelman is a law professor at Cornell Tech and Cornell Law School.
So if you give it a scientific article about DNA, it learns a little bit that the words DNA and gene and chromosome are related. It learns the words, learns the high-level patterns. It puts all of that together in a way that's very hard for us to understand exactly how it's storing this information. But at the end of the process, it's stored a huge amount about the statistical patterns in how people use language.
Can I just stop you for a second? You mentioned that nobody understands how the large language model is storing this information. But I don't get that. I would think that the computer scientists behind this, I would think that you, who've been studying this for a long time, you're a computer scientist yourself, you're one of the foremost experts in this field, you would all know how all of this works. So what do you mean we don't know?
What I mean by that is that we don't know where these models are storing what they know. We can't point to a specific part of the model and say, this is where it understands what a bird looks like, or this is the part that knows French. That information is somehow spread out through the whole thing. It's the same way that we can't point to a person's brain and say, this is the part of the brain that knows what their aunt's face looks like.
No one really knows what's going on inside the computer. But one fact beyond dispute is that in order to work, large language models need immense amounts of data. In other words, the LLMs need to read a lot. Well, it's not really reading, but ingesting everything on the web. Wikipedia, Reddit, fan fiction, newspapers, magazines, and books. So many books. And getting that data into the computer necessarily involves a large amount of copying.
When you make a data set, you are making copies of the works. When you train a model, you are at least temporarily copying each work into the memory of the computers that you're training on.
And that's where the shadow libraries come in.
And that is where the lawsuits come in.
I was minding my own business, going about my day, when I heard from Matt Butterick.
Wait, is that Sarah Silverman?
Yeah, that was from her podcast.
How does Sarah Silverman know Matthew Butterick?
You're like, who's Matt Butterick? Well, it's exciting for me because I went to high school with him. He was a grade ahead of me.
They were friends.
Oh.
He accompanied me in the talent show when I screeched at the top of my lungs, Suddenly Seymour. Suddenly Seymour!
You know, we'd been in touch intermittently over the years.
And I always thought he was the shit. He is a genius, you know, like the kid that's like smarter than all the teachers and the teachers know it.
The lawsuits are basically ready to go. Butterick has a bunch of authors lined up, but no really big names. So he reaches out to his old friend, Sarah Silverman, to see if she'll lend some star power.
I thought, gosh, you know, maybe this is something Sarah would be interested in.
Her book was in the training data, after all.
Basically, my hope is that it will help establish precedent so that people get paid when their work is used to make the 1% of the 1% even more 1%-ier. As of now, the writers and artists that educated these systems with these books did it unwittingly and without consent. And that should not be legal.
She really feels, as I do, you know, how vital this issue is. It's creating this new snare around everybody who, you know, wants to do this stuff for a living.
And the idea is that by joining forces, we can make, you know, the future a more fair landscape for writers and for artists in this age of AI. We embrace the future, but it doesn't mean that we will let people get stomped on and swindled whilst, you know, big tech makes money off their work. They're going to do it until compelled not to. So this case is us compelling them.
Coming up on Uncommon Law. generative AI companies are facing at least half a dozen lawsuits challenging their right to train on copyrighted material without permission.
At a prima facie level, somebody building a generative AI app has to provide some justification for why it's legal for them to make all those copies.
Next time on Uncommon Law, we'll learn about their justification. Will the fair use doctrine save artificial intelligence from legal catastrophe? Uncommon Law is produced and hosted by me, Matthew Schwartz. I also did the mixing and sound design for this episode. Uncommon Law was edited by Josh Block, who is the executive producer for videos and podcasts here at Bloomberg Industry Group. The narrator for the ChatGPT version of the Game of Thrones sequel was Daniel, an artificial voice generated by the AI company 11 Labs. We figured, you know, as long as we're going to do a show about artificial intelligence, we might as well go all in. Our cover art is by Jonathan Hortarte. Special thanks to Isaiah Poritz for his help on this episode. And an additional thank you to Adam Taylor, Joel Meyer, Tom Taylor, and Cheska Antonelli. If you liked this show, please tell a friend and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. It really helps spread the word. See you next time.
Smart litigators find winning arguments faster with Bloomberg Law. Our market-leading docket coverage has AI-driven search and analytics, customized alerts, and expanded state court coverage. And that's not all. Visit pro.bloomberglaw.com for everything you need to win.
Please summarize in detail the first episode of the Uncommon Law series on artificial intelligence.
The first episode of the Uncommon Law series explores the implications of AI-generated content on copyright laws. It begins with a reading from a book purportedly part of George R.R. Martin's A Game of Thrones series, but which was actually written by ChatGPT. The episode delves into the challenges and legal issues surrounding AI's ability to mimic the style of famous authors. It discusses the conflict between technological advancement and copyright law, focusing on lawsuits filed by authors against AI companies for copyright infringement. The episode also examines the concept of shadow libraries and the use of unauthorized content in training AI models, raising questions about the legality and ethical implications of such practices.
That's not bad.